Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
Giant corporate conglomerates may control your health insurance, your hospital, your doctor's office, and your pharmacy, and it's costing American families over $37,000 a year in employer insurance coverage alone. It's time to break up big medicine. In this episode of Care Talk, Emma Freer of the American Economic Liberties Project unpacks the corporate consolidation crisis destroying American healthcare and the growing bipartisan movement to fix it. Welcome to Care Talk Live, a weekly American healthcare policy show and podcast where we explain how healthcare works or doesn't work and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get future Care Talk shows. Big medicine conglomerates profit at every point along the healthcare supply chain, and that's a conflict of interest sickness at the heart of our healthcare system. A Glass-Steagall for healthcare plan, separating payers from providers, is a structural cure. So welcome Emma Freer, a senior policy analyst for healthcare at the American Economic Liberties Project. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
So let's start with talking about, what is corporate consolidation? What do you mean by all the pieces of healthcare, all the various big companies have just gotten bigger and badder?
Yeah. You know, when I think of consolidation, I'm thrown back to high school history class when you learn about Standard Oil. And so thinking about consolidation, there's kind of two main forms. One is horizontal consolidation, which is when, you know, one sector consolidates all the hospitals become one hospital, or all the insurers become one or just a few hospitals, or one or just a few insurers. That's an example of horizontal consolidation. And then there's vertical consolidation, where different points along the healthcare supply chain, for instance, consolidate with each other. So this is hospitals buying up physician practices, or insurance companies buying up pharmacies and pharmacy benefit managers. And over the last several decades, we've seen the healthcare industry consolidate to a really extreme degree, both across sectors and vertically between sectors.
So all of this consolidation, how does it affect patients?
So what we see is that as industries have become more consolidated, costs get higher, quality goes down, innovation becomes less common, and there's less choice for consumers as independent companies, independent physician practices, independent hospitals, even smaller insurance providers get squeezed out of the market. So there's a lot of harms, and I would say not very many benefits unless you are a corporate executive or shareholder of one of the remaining big few companies.
So how this works in real life is maybe your doctor's office gets bought and they've now become a part of a hospital or a larger chain. Maybe your local pharmacist becomes part of a chain. Maybe all of the different ways in which you interact with the healthcare system, you hear different names, you get notices in the mail, and it just gets harder and more expensive to deal with, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think now it's become increasingly difficult for anyone, whether you're a patient or a clinician, or an employer or a taxpayer, to kind of get out of the web of big medicine control over our healthcare system. Even if you're on a public healthcare program, chances are it's been outsourced to a private insurance company. Maybe your physician practice that you've been going to for many years has been bought by a private equity firm or acquired by a dominant hospital in your area, or even bought by an insurance company itself. And you might not know because there's very few disclosure requirements, but I think people often feel the harms even if they aren't quite sure where they're coming from.
So, given that most people experience this as a problem, even though the companies themselves are quite profitable, they don't see this as a problem. What all can or should we be doing about it?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that this is very profitable for the big medicine companies themselves. And just quickly before mentioning what we can do about it, to kind of show the extreme profitability of the big medicine business model, there are six big medicine companies. These are insurance conglomerates, wholesale drug distributors that also own healthcare providers, on the Fortune 15. Last year, they made $34 billion in profits alone. And for context, there were no healthcare companies on the Fortune 15 in 2000. So, in just the last 25 years, we've really seen this industry dramatically change. And I think, as people have become more aware of this trend, and really concerned about the affordability and access crisis that we have in our healthcare system, they've been looking for more robust structural solutions. So one thing that I'm excited to talk to you about today is the Bipartisan Breakup Big Medicine Act, which, as the name implies, would break up these companies and address the kind of inherent financial conflicts of interest that are baked into their business model and restore competition and affordability to our healthcare system.
And this shouldn't be a partisan issue in that everyone's being taken advantage of by these big corporations and their ever-increasing prices, no matter what your political persuasion. So at least theoretically, everyone in Congress should be motivated to do something about the affordability of our healthcare system. So can you talk a little bit about there's this bill, Breakup Big Medicine Act. There are other bills. Is there a path for reform through Congress?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that this is an issue that has a lot of bipartisan support. I think members of Congress are hearing from their constituents across a lot of different channels, whether they are, families that can't afford their health care or older adults who are struggling to afford even Medicare coverage, or small business owners that are having to choose between staying open, keeping their business running, and providing health benefits to their employees, which is really important for retention and competitiveness. They're hearing from healthcare practitioners in their districts who feel like they don't have access to autonomy to make good decisions to care for their patients. So there's a really broad coalition of constituencies who are concerned about this issue, and we are seeing kind of bipartisan momentum in Congress and at the state level. So the Breakup Big Medicine Act itself was introduced by Senators Elizabeth Warren and Josh Hawley, who don't agree on much but do agree on this issue. And at the state level, we've seen deep red Arkansas and Tennessee pass their own state laws that prohibit PBMs from owning pharmacies, which is a component of the broader Breakup Big Medicine Act. So we're seeing certainly bipartisan support both at the state and federal level, which I think is encouraging as we look ahead to after the midterms. And we know that there's so much discontent among the American public about healthcare costs. So hopefully that's also motivating to people in office.
hopefully. And the situation as it is not sustainable with every piece of the healthcare system increasing their costs astronomically every year. And more people are dropping their insurance, are not picking up their prescription, are not seeing the doctor because they simply can't afford it. So we are creating a healthcare system that is going to only be an option for the very rich unless we do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier the Standard Oil analogy, and the Break Up Big Medicine Act really draws on the Glass-Steagall Act, which was passed in 1933 in response to the Great Depression. It prohibited commercial banks from owning investment banks because there was a real risk to our financial system when those two things were combined. And I would argue that the big medicine business model poses a similarly systemic risk to our healthcare system. And we're seeing that happen where people are having to choose between, having insurance and not having insurance, which is not really a choice. It's gotten so expensive. Many families are paying, a third of their income on healthcare. People are losing out on wages because their employers are paying more for health benefits. We all pay more as taxpayers to cover the rising costs of federal healthcare programs. And a lot of this money is really just padding the bottom line of these big medicine corporations and is not actually going to the delivery of care and to the providers who are taking care of patients. And so there's a lot of room to improve the system that we have.
So the Break Up Big Medicine Act makes a start, but you wouldn't say it solves the problem entirely, right? Because some parts of our system at this point, we're so far down the road that we're facing a situation like when the Wall Street crashed a few years ago and banks were too big to fail, that they were such an important part of the economy that banks could not be allowed to go bankrupt. And so some of these hospital consolidations or some of these conglomerates, the United Healthcare, for example, that owns so many different pieces, can they even be broken up?
Yeah, that's a good question. And not to belabor this Glass-Steagall analogy, but I think that bill was part of the New Deal, and the Break Up Big Medicine Act similarly needs to be part of a broader package of reforms. So I think we can't fix our healthcare system when we have this really conflicted business model that is driving consolidation and all of its harms. But the Break Up Big Medicine Act isn't the only reform that we need. So to your point, we've seen a lot of hospital consolidation. We need to have things like government price controls that set a cap on how much a hospital can charge an insurer or a patient to get rid of these really inflated kind of bogus made up prices that we see and drive a lot of fear of bankruptcy and financial ruin for American families. We need to address private equity ownership in healthcare, which is kind of a very extreme form of financialization and corporatization that has a lot of harms and sometimes, fatal consequences for patients. We need to make sure that independent hospitals and physician practices can survive and compete on a level playing field because we know that they provide better care at lower costs than their corporatized larger counterparts. We need to address big pharma patent abuse that makes drug prices very, very high in the US, where they are not nearly as high in other countries. So there are other reforms that are needed, but I think of the Break Up Big Medicine Act as kind of a necessary first step. Because we can't have a functional healthcare system when we have these corporate monopolies just extracting everything they can from the system.
So for the people listening and watching at home, if they want to find out more about the work that you're doing and show their support, how can people show that they also want to break up big medicine?
Well, we'd love for anyone to do that. Our website is breakupbigmedicine.com. And we especially want to hear from patients and clinicians and employers about how they're being affected by this, because that really guides the the policy solutions that will work and be effective. So please check out our website and reach out.
Well, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much, Laura.
And just a reminder that we have free or low-cost healthcare resources available on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. So check it out. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837. We'll answer them in future episodes. And now our experts will answer your health insurance questions. So welcome to Louise Norris, health insurance and healthcare reform analyst at healthinsurance.org, and Diane Archer, the founder and president of Just Care USA. So welcome to you both. And let's start with a question from Bear Down on Reddit to Louise. My husband underwent a routine colonoscopy in October in his 40s by an in-network doctor. Everything was fine. It was quick and good. They were expecting this to be $0 cost because it was routine and preventative. But when they received their first statement, they were floored to see that the anesthesiologist billed their insurance company for $37,000. So this person contacted Blue Cross in a panic, and they said to file appeals, but Blue Cross denied those. In the meantime, they finally received a bill from the anesthesiology office for several thousand dollars. And so Blue Cross says they won't cover it because the anesthesiologist was out of network. So Louise, what's going on here?
So this sounds like a situation where the person got their colonoscopy at an in-network facility, but the anesthesiologist wasn't in their health plan's network. This used to be a very common occurrence where anesthesiologists, radiologists, assistant surgeons would be out of network, and people would get out of network surprise bills. The No Surprises Act took effect in 2022, and it protects most patients in this sort of situation from getting these out of network bills. But the caveat here is the No Surprises Act only applies if it's a hospital outpatient department, or an ambulatory surgical center. So it doesn't apply to all medical facilities. So whether or not this person is protected by the No Surprises Act, which would mean that they can't get billed the out-of-network amount, the anesthesiologist and their health plan would have to work it out themselves, and the patient would only be responsible for in-network charges, which if this was truly a preventive colonoscopy, would be zero. But again, it does depend on what type of facility this was. So there, CMS has a No Surprises Act help desk. You can reach them at 1-800-985-3059. And I would recommend starting there. They can help you figure out, was this medical facility one that is actually covered by the No Surprises Act? And if so, then they can help you sort it out to get it to where this situation is no longer your problem, and it becomes something that the anesthesiologist and the health plan work out.
Thank you, Louise. And for Diane, Chris W828 says that they're trying to find out more information about what Medicare does and does not cover after breast cancer. In general, is there an accurate list anywhere of what Medicare will and won't cover, and for how long? Diane?
So it's a great question. Medicare covers a range of services pre and post breast cancer surgery. And it's under Part A for inpatient care, Part B for outpatient care, and Part D for prescription drugs that are outpatient. And Medicare doesn't have a list of what it doesn't cover, but the good news with Medicare is it covers all medically necessary and reasonable services. So for the inpatient services, it covers your surgery, it covers your reconstructive surgery, including prosthetic devices, breast implants, after your surgery. Under Part B, it covers diagnostic tests, it covers your physician services, it covers your chemotherapy, your injected chemotherapy drugs. So again, a range of services. And then under Part D, if you're taking pills related to your breast cancer, it will cover those as well. So again, you can go on medicare.gov or otherwise online to medicareinteractive.org for a list explaining the range of different services that Medicare covers for people with breast cancer. But the truth is, if it is medically reasonable and necessary, it should be covered.
Thank you, Diane. That is good and helpful information. And now a question from Icy Welcome, who is 21 years old, looking at health insurance after they just lost coverage. So they're new to health insurance because they've been covered by a family member their whole life. So they're deciding between different plans with different costs and different dollar deductibles. It sounds like they may also qualify for a discount through Covered California. So is it better to pay more a month to get a better plan with lower deductible? How should somebody who's getting insurance for the first time think about how all this works? Louise.
Sure. And I actually kind of want to get into the specific details that this person provided, because this is a really common scenario where people often don't understand the nuance. So this person did mention that they have an option to get coverage through work, but they're also looking on Covered California. Almost always, if you have an option to get coverage through work, you are not actually eligible for subsidies in the marketplace. And that you won't see that when you're just using the anonymous browsing tools for the marketplace. Like if you're on Covered California's website and you click on the Get a Quote button, it will just prompt you to enter your zip code, your age, your income, and then it will pull up all these plans. And this person specifically mentioned that one of the plans they're being offered is they call it a Silver 73 plan. That tells me what your income is. Basically, you're in a range. This person is earning somewhere between $31,000 and $39,000 a year. Otherwise, they wouldn't be seeing that plan. But they're also being offered a plan through their work for $320 a month. And they're wondering if they should take that plan through their work or the Covered California plan. In almost all cases, if they choose the Covered California plan, they're not going to be eligible for any subsidies. They won't actually qualify for that Silver 73 plan. They will only qualify for full price plans. And sometimes people might think, well, what if I just don't tell Covered California about the work plan? The problem is their employer reports all this to the IRS as well. So then when you go to reconcile your subsidy next year at tax time, the IRS will make you repay that full subsidy. So the only situations where you qualify for a subsidy, even if you have an option of coverage through your job, is if the coverage through your job doesn't meet the federal definition of affordability, which might not be the same as your definition of what's affordable, and or it doesn't meet the federal definition of what's considered comprehensive enough. The vast majority of employer-sponsored plans do meet the definition, the federal definition of affordable and the federal definition of comprehensive enough. So if in doubt, if you're being offered a plan through your employer and you just think this is way too expensive or this coverage feels terrible, it's in your best interest to talk to someone at the marketplace. Don't just use their tool. Make sure you call and talk to someone and talk to someone at your human resources department at your employer to find out for sure whether you are actually eligible for those subsidies. If that's the case, then you and your coverage isn't considered affordable through your employer or isn't considered comprehensive enough, you can reject it and you can still qualify for a marketplace subsidy. But if you just reject it because in your opinion, it's too expensive and you feel like you could get a better deal in the marketplace, you will end up having to repay that entire subsidy when you file your taxes, which is an unwelcome surprise. Now that we've addressed that, then the other issue of like deciding if you're looking at multiple plans, oftentimes employers offer more than one plan, or if you are going through Covered California or one of the other marketplaces that are in each different state, you'll have lots of different options available. And it is a balancing act of looking at the price that you're going to pay every month combined with the out-of-pocket costs you're going to have. And I think the thing to keep in mind is don't just assume that your health is going to continue to be the same from one year to the next. You can't just assume that the number of times you saw the doctor or the medications you took last year will be the same as the coming year. So you always really want to pay attention to that, the big number, which is the maximum out of pocket. That's your worst case scenario. Make sure that if you're going with the plan that has a low premium to save money on that every month, that you're going to actually be able to afford to pay that maximum out of pocket if a worst case scenario happens and you do need to meet it.
Absolutely. Because you might be healthy until you're not. Exactly. It could be a car accident, could be a bad diagnosis. And then your health insurance and healthcare needs for that year will be very different.
Yes. And this year, the maximum is as high as $10,600, depending on the plan you have. Next year, that's climbing to $12,000. And some plans might actually have out-of-pocket limits as high as $15,600 next year. So those are not the sort of numbers that you want to be unaware of and then find out when you are hospitalized or you have a broken leg or something like that. You need to know going into it, okay, this is my worst case scenario. It's $12,000 out of pocket. Would I be able to manage that? And if the answer is no, it might be worth paying more every month to get a plan that has a lower out of pocket.
Thank you, Louise. And a question from Lo Zucchini. Their mother lives in California and recently switched over to Medicare as part of her retirement process. So she must have gone from employer insurance to Medicare. And her Ozempic for diabetes isn't being covered. She hasn't taken Ozempic for weight loss. She's been diabetic for over 20 years. She was prescribed metformin previously, but due to changes in her diagnosis, medications have been adjusted. So, what is the situation with Medicare and Ozempic, especially for diabetes?
Okay, great question. Medicare does cover Ozempic for people with diabetes needing disease management. And whether you're in traditional Medicare or Medicare Advantage, the drug is covered under Medicare Part D, the prescription drug piece of Medicare. So that's the good news. However, every Medicare prescription drug plan, every Part D plan has what's called a formulary, which is a list of drugs it covers. And the Part D plans are not required to cover Ozempic for people with diabetes. They might have a different drug that another GLP-1 on their formulary. So if you really need Ozempic and it is not on your formulary, then it would be helpful to have your doctor weigh in as to why it's medically necessary, why other alternative drugs are not going to be effective for one reason or another. You have bad side effects, you've tried them. That's probably the way to go. If the drug is on the formulary and you've been denied, you should have your doctor intervene and explain why it's medically necessary through an appeal. And again, in most of these cases, the appeal will get approved, but it is not uncommon for the Part D drug plans, private plans, to deny approval in a prior authorization process of a drug that should be covered. And that's just unfortunate, but that seems to be what's happening all too often. And again, if the drug is not on the formulary and there is no other drug available, a doctor explaining why an exemption is warranted is a smart way to go. And then, of course, every fall, when your mother is during the annual open enrollment period for Medicare and your mother can choose new options, she should look carefully at her Part D plan options and make sure that Ozempic is on the formulary of the Part D plan that she chooses, whether she's in a Medicare Advantage plan or in traditional Medicare.
Thank you, Diane. And thank you, everyone, for joining us to learn more about healthcare policy, patients' rights, the fight for a just healthcare system, and answers to your questions on health insurance and healthcare. So be sure to check out more free or low-cost healthcare resources on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next in a couple weeks for more, and be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk. Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.